Hey guys, it's your host Julian. This week I am joined by Rocco's Modern Life creator, Mr. Joe Murray. This was an extremely fun episode of just getting to chat with Joe about Rocco's early beginnings and a lot of cool stories about Static Cling. I want to give a special shout out to a couple of our patrons that help make this podcast possible. Bill, Brent, Brittany, Call Me Spikey, Eight-Legged Bird, Jacob, and Nick. Thank you all so much for your support. It truly means a lot. If you want to become a patron and help support this show, check the show notes below and sign up today. Now, let's get to my chat with the great Joe Murray. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to What's My Head Podcast. I'm Mr. Julian. Today, I'm joined by Joe. Joe, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Oh, man. Thank you for, I know you hear it a lot. Thank you for a fun childhood, man. Rocco was one of those shows, you know, I told you before we hit record, Rocco was one of those shows that I had to sneak around and watch because my older sister, she was a tattletale. And, you know, I don't know what my mom saw. I mean, I'm pretty sure going back and looking at some of it now, I probably shouldn't have watched it as like a 5-6 year old. But I remember my mom saying, absolutely not, with two shows from Nickelodeon, this one and then Rugrats, because she didn't want her kids acting like Angelica Pickles, man. But sneaking around watching Rocco's Modern Life, man, such a fun show. I would love to know, where does the idea for Rocco come in? And then when do you start pitching it? Was Nickelodeon always the place you were going to pitch it?
No, I don't. I just to backtrack a little bit, I just wanted to say that we were striving, as far as your parents not wanting you to watch it, we were striving for having things go over the kids' heads that would affect them and let them just enjoy the cartoon for what it was. But yeah, parents watching or walking into the room at the wrong time was usually our downfall. The kids themselves were like, what? I don't understand what's going on. But which was planned. But yeah. So, but maybe some of these things should have been a discussion with the parents. I don't know. But so hopefully things were enjoyed later on when you knew what we were talking about at times. But I mean, this story has been told a million times. I had no interest in getting into television. I didn't pitch Rocco per se. I was approached by Linda Saminsky, which I know you've had on your show before. She's fantastic. And she was a big fan of animation. She kept track of the independent film community, and she was quite involved. I think she was a member of ASIFA and all these different groups. So a lot of people knew her. And I coincidentally had another independent film in the works. Excuse me. And I sent a copy to Nickelodeon thinking maybe I could get some funding from them. Maybe they might want to show it. I don't know. It was a very new channel, and they didn't have any original cartoons or anything, but I don't know. I think my accountant represented somebody, an executive worked at Nickelodeon or something like that. Anyway, so I sent a VHS there, and I didn't hear anything, and I didn't really expect to hear anything. I was just looking around. And suddenly I got a call from Linda, and she said, we're not interested so much in your film, but do you have any ideas for an animated series? And like cartoons on TV, which at the time were not so inspired and not so intelligent. And I said, I don't feel my stuff has any place on television. And I said, my stuff is too weird. And she says, that's what we're looking. We're looking for that. We're looking for weird. She says, we're looking for something different. And I go, yeah, because TV animation is not so great right now. And she goes, yeah, because we are trying to do a new thing on Nickelodeon and have some creators do some things that they want to do. And I'm like, let me think about it. And I did some research on Nickelodeon, and it was like Inspector Gadget and still all these things. I said, I don't know. So I decided to come up with an idea. So I started thinking, if I were to watch a cartoon on television, what would it be? What would it be like? And that's exactly what I designed. And And this was before they had come out with Nicktoons, so I had no idea. I just thought it was too weird. It's not going to go anywhere. I had had enough experience with trying to get into comic strips for them to say my stuff was too weird. So I was enjoying doing my independent films, which it didn't matter if they were weird because they were independent films, and I didn't have anybody telling me what to do. So anyway, Linda really liked it when I sent her a pitch, which was, my version of pitching. I didn't know, I don't know the business so well, but I had some time in advertising, so I actually put together a little presentation, and she liked it, and her boss liked it, and so they started moving forward on it, and then on the in the Nicktoons, when we started coming to a place where we were thinking about doing a pilot, that's when Nicktoons came out. And Ren and Stimpy, of course, I was like, I love this. I love this. And these guys are taking chances. They're risking putting this stuff on the air. And maybe this is a place for my work. Maybe. So yeah. So that's basically how it went, and it moved forward. And the test audiences really didn't know what to make of it. Rocco. Yeah. And it took a few years for the audience to really understand what was going on, I feel. And it's actually it feels more popular now than it even was in the 90s. I don't know. It was a strange, also for me going into television, it was very strange. And it was not really on my part wanted or pursued. So that's that story, yeah.
Yeah, do you think with well, taking a step back, but also taking a step forward, because there's another creator that I had on, Paul Tremaine. And when it comes to Nickelodeon, there are foundational pieces, both to Nickelodeon and Cartoon Network when you start building out that network, because you can draw a lot of similarities. Nickelodeon had just started doing cartoons, and you had Ren and Stimpy, like you had mentioned, and then Rugrats came out, Doug came out, and then why am I blanking on the other one?
Simpsons.
What's
Simpsons.
that?
Well, Paul brought out Simpsons, which was also a big, huge step.
Yeah, so
Yeah.
they were building that foundational piece for Nickelodeon to really branch off of, right? When you look back, and what's crazy about what you just said, that you feel like it's more popular now than it was back in the 90s, and then the Rugrats, everybody remembers the Rugrats being this monster hit, but the Rugrats didn't really hit until it kind of went into, like, I think their second or third season, like halfway through 95, 96, what Paul said, when it started just playing on repeat. It was the rerun, 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 and then it started amassing this whole fan base. Now obviously you said you feel like it's more popular now than it was back then. Do you think it's because of the movie Static Cling hitting Netflix and then a whole new audience being introduced to Rocco? Or why do you think it's more popular now so than it was back then?
I feel like I think audiences started getting acclimated to the weirdness of it, but the relatability of modern life, I feel, really hit home. And it took for some people to grow up and understand some of the things we were talking about. I don't know, and I think there's a certain nostalgia for there seems to be an overall nostalgia for 90s cartoons coming through as a breaking wave. So I think that lends a lot to it. But the reason why we did Static Cling was because there was a calling for it. For Nickelodeon saw the popularity of Rocco, so there was a place for it. And I had a new vision of what modern life was, and it just clicked, it gelled. So.
Watching that movie, and we'll talk about the original run here in just a sec, but I want to stay on Static Cling for a minute. Watching that movie was so weird because I felt myself going through the same shit that Rocco was, like all of the electronics. Because I can remember just going out with my friends, and then the like, there's a meme that goes around. And this is when you knew your friends were home. All of the bikes were in the front yard. I remember that. I remember being able to go someplace and not having a phone. I remember being able to go place. I remember fucking kindergarten or first grade, whatever it was. They showed us how to print something from a printer. I remember it being like a magical thing. I'm like, oh my God, you can select this picture and it prints it, right? So going through all of those emotions with Rocco while Rocco's doing this with a character that I fucking grew up with, I'm like, holy shit. It's like you guys nailed that existential crisis, if you will, or that midlife crisis for Rocco. But I'm like, oh man, I remember a time where it was so much easier. Like every generation says it was so much easier in my day, or it was so much harder, yada, yada, yada. There's so many similarities that you can draw through every generation with the same kind of tropes. But Static Cling, it hit, and I'm like, oh fuck, man. I loved the take. I loved how you guys took it strictly from the 90s, because that's something I've always been fascinated by. Like, you take something, you take the caveman and you pluck him, it's Encino Man essentially, and you pluck him in today. What do you do? How does it happen? What goes on? You know what I mean?
Well, and I didn't know it at the time, but we set it up perfectly with the last episode of Rocco to send him off into space, because that was immediately where I had gone to say what would happen if they came back, in this whole new world that they had, and it was all modern life, it was still, and yeah, we've been going through an enormous change. Everybody has, the collective, the human species has, the world has, the climate has, the politics has, everything. We didn't get into politics at all, but just the social culture changed so much. So it was ripe, really. The whole idea of Static Cling was change, and how we were feeling about it. So it was really a no-brainer to see how Rocco was going to adapt to that. But I also feel that in a way that I was kind of poking fun a little bit at people who were so nostalgic about wanting their old show back. It was kind of poking fun at the fact, can we do a Static Cling up, reboot? And also Craig Bartley was like, yeah, we're rebooting Arnold. Hey, Arnold, like, how great is that? Well, I don't know. I don't know it. And that's the thing is, but also when I first was approached by Nikolai, I says, I don't know, we could fuck this up real bad. I don't know if I want to do it. And because I feel really good about the existing episodes of Rocco, I don't want to mess with it. But so for people to say, let's do it, it's not always a good idea, as we've seen, to reboot shows and sequels to movies that were perfectly fine on their own in the first one. But that's Hollywood. They'll hammer something to death till they just, punch the life out of it. But I don't know. So it worked really well. I'm really happy with it. And Cosmos Sigerson, who helped me direct and write, and Tom Smith, and the whole group of people that worked on it were just amazing. So, and Doug Lawrence and Martin Olson working with me again for us to polish out the story. I wrote the original story, but the three of us came around and sat together and hammered out a lot of the details of it. And of course, Doug is, well, they're both really warped. And the three of us stumbled on the idea of, I don't want to do any spoiler alerts, but the main change, and we said this is as perfect, and Ralph, it was a perfect character to go through his change. So yeah, it just really worked well. So I don't, I feel like it was pretty well received. There's a definitely a lot of conversations going on afterwards about whether we were woke or whether we, it sparked a lot of debate, which is good. And I told them, I said to Nickelodeon before I agreed to do it, I'm not doing some watered down version of Rocco. Because I know Nickelodeon has changed and their views on how they what they promote and what they put on the air. And I was like, I don't know if what I want to do is going to end up on the air. And it turned out it didn't. But I said I want it to be as cutting edge as what we were doing. And I want it to be there. And they agreed. So, but they had a little problem. Wasn't easy going. We had to actually go to the president of Nickelodeon, and she had to sign off on the ultimate final idea. So, yeah, it worked well.
It worked well is an understatement. I mean, I felt like, this it's looked at so weird right now, like nostalgia, the 90s era. Like, some people are against having fan service, some people want it, some people like, oh, I was very we not I we were very, like, my family was very, very, I don't want to say poor, and that's not really the it was hard, right? My mom was a single mom most of the time. There was, it depending on the era, it was 4 to 5 of us. So my senior year, or excuse me, my high school year, my mom worked, or my high school time, my mom worked 2 jobs to support us. So money was very, very tight, so we couldn't afford a lot. So as I gotten older, joined the military, got out, did some things, I've made some money. I fill my room with my childhood. I try to buy back my childhood so I can get a little peace. I mean, your characters are right here, right there. I got your characters right there, and I've got other characters that are coming on, so it's weird sitting back and hearing just the fan base, not just Rocco, just in general for cartoons in the era I grew up in. It's like people want them, but people don't want them. They want to be able to have their cartoons because it feels like a piece of them. So whenever it reboots, whenever it sequelizes, whenever a series comes back to life with or without the creator, people are very hesitant. I'm glad that, you were a part of it. You got to put Joe all in throughout, because it wouldn't have been the same. It was the same thing when Craig McCracken, in 2016, when they redid the Powerpuff Girls without him. That's why that show did not work, because they didn't have the
Big
heart and the
mistake.
soul. Huge mistake. And then I think they learned their lesson. Now, with it going up the way it went, obviously we won't talk about, ladies and gentlemen, you got to go watch it. I believe it's on Netflix still. You got to go and watch it, so you can hear what we're talking about. But was that the only thing that you had to go and get really signed off? Though, spoiler alert, you didn't want to mention with the big change. Was that the only thing that you had to go up and see the head of Nickelodeon for? Or was there anything else that you had to really push for?
No, we well, I mean, they were on board with most of it, and but I knew still that it was going to have a hard time finding a slot on the air, and they were never really sorry, my cat is on my table. They were never very clear about when it was going to go on the air. And then when I saw Hey Arnold go on, and then it just kind of went on and then fizzled, and Nickelodeon just kind of put it on the shelf. And I didn't like that either, because I don't know where they're going to bury this. So when they sold it to Nickelodeon, to Netflix, I was ecstatic, because I thought that was a perfect home for it, and it really worked out well, and it's still there, and you can watch it. It's not on a shelf, and it's being enjoyed by many people, fans and new fans and people who've never experienced it before. Hopefully, even though there's a gazillion Easter eggs in it, I feel like it can still be enjoyed, by someone who didn't have that history.
Oh,
So,
yeah, absolutely.
yeah, but other than that, they were very supportive. Chris Viscardi, was very supportive of everything that we were doing, and he was fantastic to work with. So.
That's really cool, man. There's two shows in particular that I think. Hey Arnold is one of my favorite shows of all time. That show helped mold me to the person I am today. I mean, it's King of the Hill, And hey, Arnold, when I think about the two shows that spoke to me as a kid, both, kid and then teenager into an adult, it's those two in particular. But in my opinion, man, I'm so glad that this went to Netflix, in particular, your show, yours with Static Cling and Rocco, and then Invader Zim. I don't think those two shows in particular got, when they think of Nickelodeon, where they bring up Nickelodeon, those two shows I always feel like are shortchanged. They're never mentioned enough. You'll see Rocco, like you see a lot of his t-shirts in places like Spencer's and things like that. You're starting to see more of it now just because of that hunger for the 90s, that hunger for wanting to feel like a kid again. And in my opinion, 90s animation is the greatest era of animation. You guys really started the golden age. Most people call the second golden age, but in my opinion, it's the greatest era of cartoons of all time was what you guys kicked it off with Nickelodeon and Cartoon Network. So I love what you did. I'm so glad Netflix picked it up because I think it was perfect because this is a different era. This is a different time. This is a different fan base. With that being said, with all of the difference that was going into Static Kling and you being older at that point and the crew being older, so you've got all of this time, all of this perspective, all of this added knowledge that you've gained throughout the years. Was it hard slipping back into Rocco, or did it still feel like a comfortable pair of shoes?
It still felt pretty comfortable because so much of Rocco was me, and so that felt pretty normal. What was odd was that I was working on a PBS show at the time, also, Let's Go Luna, and I only go where Linda Zminski goes. So
That's good.
she went to PBS, and Craig Bartlett and I both followed her. No, but I've been wanting to do a PBS show also because it was commercial free and I really liked, and I had two young kids at the time. So, and
My
I
littles
believed in.
love it, by the way. I don't
I'm
mean to
sorry.
interrupt you, but I said I don't mean to interrupt you, but my littles love that the show. We watch a lot of PBS, so
Oh, good.
they really enjoy it.
Well, it was also at a time when I really wanted to expose a lot of kids to different cultures, and I felt the idea was really ripe, and also my interest in travel was, it was a perfect fit for me. But what was interesting was is that sometimes I would spend the morning working on the PBS show and then go over in the afternoon and work at Nickelodeon on the on Static Kling, which were two different opposite
Right and left
places to
brain type of
be.
thing.
So it was a bit of a mind fuck at times, and yeah, so you had to switch gears, and that was interesting, but it didn't, it felt so natural. And also when Doug Lawrence and Martin Olsen and I got into a room, it was like no time had passed. We were together, and I'm sorry, cat is.
Oh, it's fine. Linda's cat gets up every time we record with Linda. Linda's cat makes an appearance at least for 10 or 15 minutes. So it's par for the course.
Where was I? Yes.
Doug and
Yeah,
Martin get in
that
the room.
there was no time. And Martin and Doug are just Martin and Doug and I are, we're a team. So in that sense, it was really fun to do. That's I think that it was funny. We were at Comic-Con, and they were asking me, what was the thing that surprised you the most about doing Static Kling? And I said that it was so much fun to do for me. Because there were things about the original show that were some old wounds, I wasn't interested in opening up any old wounds on that. And I was a little hesitant on how it would be. Nickelodeon had turned into such a huge conglomerate that you really have no clue like how experiences are going to go. But it turned out to be a very good one. So.
What was it like hiring? So you said Doug and Martin came back along, so they were on, the original run. What was it like having like an entire new crew now? You've got new board artists, new writer, or well, not new writers because you guys helped write that together. But you've got a whole new crew now, and probably some of these folks that were working on your show were fans, like kids at that time. So what was that like?
Yeah, that was actually a real boost for it because, as you know, we write the show also in storyboards. So we don't what Martin and Doug and I did was basically a detailed outline of the show. That's how we did it, in the original show, and that's how I still did my other shows. The storyboard artists really end up writing the details and the dialogue and everything else. So Dan Becker and Tom Smith and Cosmo and I storyboarded it out, and Dan Becker and Tom Smith were big fans of Rocco when they were kids. Yeah. And Tom Smith, I think, knew more about Rocco than I did, which is he was always correcting me. It's so funny. He corrected me if we didn't get things right, because he knew it by, I don't know how many times. And Tom is like, and Tom and I go way back because he actually interned for me when he was going through school. And so we knew each other. And then, and he worked for me in other ways as we went on. And so it was great. And so he really cut his teeth on working in the industry for before Rocco. So he really knew how to do it and storyboard really well. And actually Tom came and worked with me on the PBS show for a little bit too also. But yeah, he had a whole different, him and Dan and Cosmo had a very different, not a different, but a fresh approach to things. And by while still maintaining, they were so into the integrity of the show. Cosmo really also was like, we need to get this right, to the point where we went to the Korean studio that was doing the animation, and Cosmo really spearheaded the fact that we have the pencil line look exactly like the 90s show, to the point where we would Xerox the drawings, because that's what you did back in the 90s when you did them on cel, to make the pencil line look exactly right for when we, and then, but we would digitize it. And then even in post-production, we added a little bit of, roughness to it to give it that
Aesthetic.
35 millimeter film look,
Yeah.
But anyway, they were all so full of energy and so enthusiastic about the project that it really spilled over. So yeah, it was a definite advantage for that.
That's so cool, man. I love getting to hear and see like when fans get to work. So I'm a huge Ninja Turtle fan. The last Ninja Turtle movie that came out, Mutant Mayhem, you can tell fans of the show worked on it, or fans of the comics, fans of the movie. You can really tell when somebody absolutely loves what they're doing because it just oozes off the screen. No pun intended.
Absolutely.
It just you can feel everything, right? So getting to know that not only were fans of the show, the original show, fans of you got to work on it, man. That's why those added layers of love keep coming in. And I hate to keep circling back to that, but it's just like getting to sit down and watch something you grew up with, whether your parents knew about it or you didn't know about it, and then you get to see this shit as an adult. And then I showed this to my so we have three kids. I have a 14-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a 1-year-old. So the 14-year-old, when this one came out, I can't remember how long ago it came out, but he was still pretty young, and it's a whole new era compared to the cartoons I grew up with to what he's growing up with. So we're sitting here watching this. I'm like, I don't think he got that. And I'm looking over. Okay, yeah, he didn't get that reference. But watching him watch Rocco with me, it was such a weird kind of. It was weird because I was like, my mom never would have sat down and watched this cartoon with me. And dad, it's just like, I don't care, man. They're gonna see, they can literally pull out their phone and see anything they want to. You know what I mean? So what the fuck is this cartoon really gonna do to him that Google won't eventually? You know what I mean? So sitting there laughing, and I get to share another piece of my childhood with him. So hopefully, like, he'll do the right thing and then just like continue to pass that torch down to his kids and his kids' kids with Rocco, with Hey Arnold, with King of the Hill, with all of these shows that I grew up with. But there was one thing I did, or a couple things I did want to circle back to with the original series. I told you before we had hit record, and that was a long-winded way of me saying the movie was fantastic. It was enjoyed by a younger generation. I'm hoping that he'll want to watch more of it because I've got the entire series on DVD. I took that with me every time I deployed. That was one of the shows that I always went to because
Oh,
deployments are
wow.
anywhere 9 months to a year, depending on, how long it was. So, I always had Hey Arnold, I always had King of the Hill. Rocko was another DVD. So I would just buy all of these cartoons and shows that I grew up with that would give me a piece of home when I felt really, really, disconnected from my family, So thank you for that. With that being said, one thing that there's multiple things that stand out. I absolutely love the intro for this show. In my opinion, it's the top three of all time. And I'm not going to put them in order because that's not fair. And I wouldn't want to put that pressure on myself. But Batman, the animated series, Rocko, and Hey Arnold have the those are my three favorite intros for any show, right? The song, the theme music, the animatics, it was so beautiful. Do you know how or remember how that kind of came about? That was that something you worked on, the board artist worked on? But how does an intro like that come to be?
Well, I animated most of it, and Tim Bjorklund worked a little bit on it. No, I boarded the whole thing. In fact, I was going through some sketchbooks because I pulled them out for my Patreon thing, and I have the original sketches of fleshing that whole intro out. So it was a It told a story, basically, and I wanted it to be very, and it was a little fashioned after I had done some MTV ID spots. I don't know if you're old enough to remember. They used to have these animated, with the MTV logo coming up, and I did a couple of those. So it was kind of fashioned after that whole feel of an MTV ID spot, but it told the story. And I definitely related with, getting your head stuffed full of facts and getting flicked into the real world is I
It's
can
real.
relate. I can relate with that. Getting hit with a baseball, I was a big baseball. I'm still a baseball fan, but I played a lot of little league baseball when I was young. So that it was very you get plopped into this world, And you're on for the ride. And that was basically what I wanted to say with it. The music was we had a different song. The first season had a different cue. I think it was done by Sarah Frost, and it was good. It was good, but I had always wanted to have the B-52s on do the music for the show. That was my first thing. So Pat Irwin of the B-52s came on to score it, and I said, "Can we get, Fred and Kate at least to come in and do the B-52s for the title song?" And he said, "Sure." So he rewrote it, and I was there for the record. It was awesome, and in Greenwich Village, I believe it was, in a studio. Yeah, and that's how it came about. So, but yeah, a lot of that animation is mine. I remember telling, we had a producer at the time. They hooked me up with some producer, which we didn't get along, and he was off the show in a short time. But
Good.
he was always telling, saying, "You're doing too much on this show. You're doing too much. Yeah, we're running behind schedule. You can't do all this." And I go, "Yeah, I can. I can." And then if I said, he goes, "We need a title sequence." I go, "Okay, I'm animating it." "Oh, what the fuck? You're gonna animate it? Like, really? Where are you gonna find that time?" I'm like, "I don't care. I'm gonna do it." And I did most of it, and then Tim Bjorklund also did a bit of it, and he worked on the original pilot with me up in the Bay Area, so he was also a great animator, still is, and so the two of us did it, and I really liked it, so.
Like I said, it's top three for me of all
Thank you.
time.
Thank you.
And I'm gonna take it one step further. I've never told anybody this. I'll actually screenshot the email. So I was working, not working with before we had our third kid, 2 and 2 years essentially. Before we had our third kid, a lot of like my extra money that I would save up, I'm dumping back into this show, right? Because I want to put more money into this to give people more whatever they're looking for. And I really wanted an intro. And I was cooking breakfast or lunch or dinner or something. I can't remember what it was. But our middle child was still really young. Like, he was so young, he was still immobile essentially. So I didn't have to chase him around the house like I'm chasing him around the house and around every place now. But I had Rocco on, and then I remember just watching the opening, the title sequence, and going, man, that is such a cool fucking intro. And I had this thought. I was like, I've talked to all these people already at this point. I was like, I wanted to be inspired by Joe, but just like do what Joe did. And I was like, I think it'd be a cool intro for my podcast. And I was working with a guy that does intros and animation. I saw him on Instagram, and I was like, I sent him a clip of the intro for your show. And I was like, I think it would be really cool to navigate the world of all the guests I've talked to in a Batmobile, you know what I mean? In a Batmobile, and then just do this, but like in Joe Murray's style. And the guy was just so fucking like, so like, let's do it, because he loved your show. And he was so up for it. And then I literally find out like my wife is pregnant, and I'm like, oh shit, this is gonna cost me some money. Not the baby. The baby's gonna cost money, but like the animation thing, this is gonna cost me a lot of money. So it's like, hey man, just found out we're having our third kid. I was like, I got to put this on pause for quite some time. So I was like, if I can, I'm save all your information. I'll get back out to you when, I got my head financially above where I'm supposed to have it before I start adding all this extra shit. And he was super cool. He was like, no problem. It shit happens. You're having a baby. Congratulations. But yeah, your intro inspired me to go and find my own animator, but like do it your way, do it in your intro, but do it like with me. So like I said, I love the fucking intro. There was another couple things I wanted to circle back to. Now I know I pre-gamed you with this one, but there was actually two people I wanted to talk about that are sadly no longer here. I know Tuck never worked on Rocco, but Tuck did work on Camp Lazlo, which was another one of my favorite shows of all time. And I've had so many people on that have gotten to work with Tuck, and I've heard some really cool stories from both SpongeBob days and both Hey Arnold days. So when you think of Tuck Tucker, is there anything that comes to mind? Is a funny story, funny moment, or what's the first thing that comes to mind when you think of
Well,
Tuck?
I love Tuck, he was actually working closely with my ex-wife to on the Hey Arnold development, and at the time we had two kids and he had kids, so they came over a lot to we had little barbecues and stuff, all that suburban stuff. So absolute joy, person to be around. I he was always so upbeat, and I was like, Mr. Down, Joe, Rocco Joe, I call him. But he was always like, "Hey, what's going on?" It was always a good. It was always a good day with Tuck, and so. When we were looking around for storyboarders and directors on Lazlo, he came up available. It was just and so he came and worked with us for a bit, and it was a great situation. I don't know if I have any specific stories because Tuck was just an all around great guy, but I don't know. I heard some stories of him in Korea, doing lots of crazy hiking, and he was always so very active. So I don't know. I don't have any specific stories really. All I know is that he always had a smile on his face, and he always was so positive. And he had done some great episodes. I can't remember offhand which episodes of Lazlo that he did, but. But he was a quick wit and a fantastic artist, and yeah, I miss him.
It's he's one of those guys that like I said, there's a few folks that always come up depending on what era of cartoons we're doing, and he's one of them. You know, I had Craig on, and Craig probably told him and Dave Cunningham's on Patrick Starr's show. They told two of my favorite stories, and I'll share this with you really quick. Tuck kept getting a sandwich eaten at Nickelodeon. I can't remember what show he was working on, but it was really starting to piss him off. So we put a note on it that says, "Do not touch, do not touch," and a sandwich keep coming up missing. So Craig tells me that a shit sandwich essentially ended up in the community fridge over at Nickelodeon, wrapped up same way, do not touch, do not touch. And somebody took a sandwich, and nobody took a sandwich after that one. And he said he had this, I think he had a hunting dog or something like that. And his dog was named Bruno. And he's like, I don't know if it was a Bruno shit or if it was a Tucker shit, but essentially a shit sandwich ended up in the Nickelodeon community fridge. And Tuck's sandwich never got taken again. The other one was Dave Cunningham. And he was like, Tuck's favorite holiday was April Fool's Day. He's like, he loved playing pranks. He loved playing practical jokes
I can
on
see
people.
that.
So he had taken Dave's phone and then coded. This is when they had the phone where you had to stick it up to your ear and everything like that. So he took it and coated the inside of the receiver with honey. So he kept putting it up to his ear, and then he kept calling Dave so he could put it up to his ear, put it up to his ear, put it up to his ear. So by the time he was done, he had fucking honey in his ear, he had honey in his ear, and he's like, God damn it, Tuck got me again. You know, so those are my two favorite stories that I've ever gotten to hear from Tuck. But like I said, I like to bring him up just because I want that memory to stay on because he was so impactful on shows. I don't have to tell you this. I mean, he was so impactful on shows, you know, with The Simpsons, with Hey Arnold, with everything he touched, man. He was an absolute master. There is one more guy that is no longer here that I would love if you had a story or if, you know, what it was like working with him. But Steven directed my favorite Rocco episode of all time, Steven Hillenberger. You know, keeping up with the big heads. And man, like I said, went and created SpongeBob, but he got to work on Rocco with you. What was it like with the young Steven Hillenberger?
Well, when I was doing my independent films, there's festivals that you go to, and I was starting to put together a crew for Rocco. And one of my films was in Ottawa at the Ottawa Film Festival, which is a fantastic festival. And they screened this film called Wormholes, and I'm like, wow, this is so deep. This is like so great, and I love the style. And so I sought, and Steve was there. So I sought him out. I think it was in the lobby after the movie, and I told him how much I liked it, and he was very shy. He had his backpack, you know. He was just out of school, and he was very modest and very, he was, happy that somebody liked his film, because I think a lot of people didn't understand it. It was very strange. And but it was brilliant. I thought it was brilliant. And I said, and I told him what I was doing with Rocco, and he goes, "Yeah, I couldn't work in television." I go, "No, we're doing something really different." Yeah. And he goes, "But my, how can you see that my stuff would be like?" And I go, "Because you're brilliant. Because I can see it. I can see what you can do." And he goes, "Really?" Like he was like, I don't, he didn't really see it, And I said, "We're trying to get people together. I want people who are not TV people who have worked." I love that he's never worked in the industry, so he doesn't have any bad habits. That was one of the things that putting the crew together for Rocco, I wanted people that weren't already tainted by the production process, or weren't tainted by what other producers had told him to do and said, "This is the way to do it," because I didn't want any of those rules. So he came to meet with me in my studio in Saratoga in Northern California, because at the time we were going to do half the show, and the creative part was going to be in my studio in Northern California, and then there was going to be another crew in Los Angeles, which was going to be very chaotic. But he agreed to come on board, and then I had a crisis, a serious, where my wife passed. And so I moved down to Los Angeles and took the people with me that agreed to be, most of them. Some of them didn't make the move, but, and it was funny because a television executive at Nickelodeon, I won't say her name, but tried to talk me out of bringing Steve on. Who incidentally later on said that SpongeBob was a piece of crap,
Wow.
with the pilot, but no one will admit to that
No, they
now.
never do. I saw it the entire time. It had
I
the
knew
it
it was going to be
factor.
a hit,
Yeah. You
but
fucking
we've
liar.
since made up, and we're, she's great. So anyway, I love her, whatever. But she tried to talk me out of hiring Steve. Steve has no experience, and I said, yeah, that's why I like him. And I said, you watch, he's going to be our best director. I know he is. And she goes, all right, because all she saw was wormholes. He had nothing else. He had a Green Beret. I think it was called Green Beret. Is another film he'd done in school. And so yeah, so he did become one of our best directors. Him and Robert Scull worked together as I mean, all the teams were great, but their stuff I always knew was going to be. Like we gave when we were writing stuff, we got this is a Steve show. We need to give him this episode. Fish and Chumps was one of my favorites. That they did, and it was ironic because Steve went on to do stuff with marine life, and he also has a background in marine biology. He went to school for that as well. So yeah. So when it came time for me to step back a bit. In the fourth season, I asked Steve to be my creative director, to take over some of the duties, and he did a great job. And yeah, and then he created this little sponge thing, which I, didn't go anywhere. So,
No, it was a one-hit wonder, if you will.
I remember Doug Lawrence. So it was like the second season, I think it started to kick in. I think it was about this SpongeBob. And Doug Lawrence called me and he goes, "Do you see what's happening? Do you see what's happening?" Because I always thought, okay, his stuff is going to be just as quirky probably as mine, except okay, I have this story to tell, and I don't mean it in any disrespect to Steve because he was an awesome guy, but when they were going to pick up SpongeBob, which they were debating, they almost did not pick it up. But one of the things that the president of Nickelodeon went to Steve and said, "How do we know you're not going to be like Joe Murray?"
You don't want me to be awesome? What do you mean?
No, I was a pain in the ass to them. That's the way they felt. And we won't go into details about it, but
Absolutely.
I was not an easy guy to work with. And my lawyer was a very good lawyer, and they didn't like that either. So, I still get great rock and royalty checks, and they don't like that. Anyway, so they were afraid that Steve was going to be like Joe Murray, because I fought a lot for what we did on the show, and it was starting to push some boundaries, and then they were starting to become corporate, intensely corporate, and so that's when we parted ways. That's sort of like after four seasons, I said this was enough, and they said, yeah, sure, okay, that's fine, we don't care, and so they said, wait, that's enough, we're done with you too. Which is why I was surprised later on that they wanted to do a reboot. But anyway, beside all that, so Steve calls me feeling very remorseful and saying and tells me this conversation he just had, and said they asked how they know that he was going to be another Joe Murray. And he had to pretty much, kind of diss me a little bit. And he felt really bad, and he apologized. about, and I go, I don't blame you at all. I go, if that's what's going to get you your show, because it's going to be a great show, I that's fine with me. I really don't care. So, but he was so, I don't know if he dissed me, but he said, I'm not going to be like Joe Murray, which he's not like Joe Murray. I mean, he's very much his own person, but he also stood up for what he wanted on SpongeBob, and he did things his way in so many ways. The first, what, 4 or 5 seasons were just phenomenal, and that he had his hands, in everything. And very sad to see him go. It was a big shock to all of us, and it's very sad.
That run of SpongeBob, I mean, it was phenomenal, dude. It was like I really wish the guy was still around, just because like his voice is so unique, like yours. I lump you, Steven, and a guy, you probably know him being in the industry for as long as you've been, but Danny Antonucci, you guys fought.
Oh yeah, he's a
You
friend of
guys,
mine.
yeah, man, one of the when you were asking me how big my audience is,
He's
like his,
awesome.
I had all three of the Ed Boys on for the voice actors. Nobody's ever had all three of them on, even at the height of the show. That is my biggest episode of all time, almost 300,000 views. And it was something that every fan of Ed, Edd n Eddy needed, because this was our childhood, much like Rocco, much like Hey Arnold, much like SpongeBob. But what I lump all three of you guys in there together, and here's why. You guys were so beholden to your vision. You guys know I'm going to take extra time. When you said that, executive's like, you're going to animate. What the fuck, you can find time? I'll find the time. You guys were so steadfast in making sure that your voice shone through, that your vision shone through. You didn't let fucking too many cooks in the kitchen, too many people stirring the Kool-Aid. You know what I mean? It was you at the fucking helm for so long, making sure that your vision, your work, your sight got made. And it's like, I applaud you, because there's so many people that'll fold when they see a check. There's so many people, and there's nothing against them. That's not a slight. You know what I mean? If I could make money that would change my life, my kid's life, and all that other shit, fucking sign me up. You know what I mean? So it's not a slight against anybody that's ever sold anything. But it's like, so many people will not want to go against the norm. So many people will just be a buoy by seeing that wave that'll knock that buoy further down.
Yeah, but I also feel that corporations these days will not let a creator have that kind of
Not
power
anymore. Nope.
anymore. And not to kick anybody who's had a great vision for their show and tried and fought hard to get that vision. But the corporations, one of the things that I felt that at least Nickelodeon learned, and I think Disney learned, and Cartoon Network, but Cartoon Network was slower. They allowed more creator work to come through for longer time. But it kind of holds the corporation at bay a little bit, that someone has that much power and they don't like that because it's an investment for them, which I understand. A creator can hold up the production. It can cost money, it can mess with the vision that the corporations have for the show and their goals that they want for the show. It's not always like the way it was for us, where give him the reins and let's see where he goes. It's much more difficult. And I think that there's many situations now where if the creator were gone, example, Chris Sabino, that it's not a big gap for them. Back when I was doing Rocco, if I threatened to leave, that was a big gap for them because I did a gazillion jobs. Not out of, well, maybe some of it was out of ego, I don't know, but because I wanted to do it. So my show, damn it, whose show is it? That was a great episode because I was able to get a lot of my angst out yelling that. Whose show is it? Yeah. So Yeah, Danny, the thing I loved about Danny too was I remember being on a group call at Cartoon Network. I was doing Laszlo. He was still doing Ed and Eddie, and there were a few other creators on the line. And Cartoon Network had this really awful idea to embed product placement into the cartoons. And they wanted to do an event where we all did episodes that linked up to each other and would involve this product. And I said to the call, "This is a bad fucking idea." And Danny was the only other one on the line who said, "I agree with Joe, it's a bad fucking idea." And Danny basically said, "I'm not doing this." And I said, "I'm not doing this." And Danny and I we've been best buds ever since then. I remember, but no, we met up at a Comic Con, I think, and we were just we still keep in touch. He's a great guy. But he had that, but he was also, come on, he's Lupa the Butcher. He's like he was also a comrade he was doing independent film and I was doing independent film. There's a bunch of us that had that mentality of, fuck this. And
That punk rock.
he wasn't afraid to say, fuck this, And so anyway, the idea went on to become the Alien episodes that we all came together on, which I thought turned out okay, but with no product placement. And I think they were going to do Kraft cheese because we said, how about if the aliens are trying to steal cheese? How about Kraft cheese? No. We're not going to do that. No.
That's great. Thanks for sharing that story. And like I said, I've had almost that entire crew on from Ed, Edd n Eddy, and everybody says the same thing. Like you had mentioned that you got Steven when he was young, so he had no bad habits, right? I preach that in the industry. I'm in the culinary and food industry, right? So I'm a sous chef in my spot. I'd much rather somebody be green as shit, not know a fucking thing, than somebody that's been in the industry for 15, 20 years. Yeah, you got that experience for that 15 or 20 years, but you've also got a lot of bad habits, and bad habits are almost impossible to break. They know every shortcut, they ever know whatever
Yeah.
short change. So I'd much rather somebody green. And it was one thing that I heard through everybody when I did a deep dive in Edit Eddie, from board artists to writers to everybody. And everybody said the same thing. You got pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed to strive for excellence from Danny. Danny had a bar and you had to go over that bar. There was no settling. There was no going under the bar. His voice was unique and he was that buffer zone, almost like Linda was. Linda would keep the execs where the execs needed to be. Danny would keep the artists and the writers where they needed to be. And he
Right.
drew a hard line in that sand. He's like, "This is my fucking show. This is my vision. This is my voice. This is not your show. I'm letting you come along with the show." And I fucking love that so much, because for so long and so often, you've got these people that'll, like I said, it's just going back to this whole money thing, but they'll throw money at you. They'll throw all these dreams at you. And then they want to change your fucking vision. And then it's
Yeah.
not Joe anymore. It's not Danny anymore. It's not Steven anymore. It's some amalgamation of a little bit of this, a little bit of that, just so somebody can put their fucking thumbprint on it. And I love when people steadfast and they're like, "No, I'm not budging on this one. I believe in this, whether it's a good one or a bad one, I'll take it at the end of the day because it's my show, my choice,
Right.
but I want to be able to have that choice, you know?" So I always appreciate folks like yourself and folks like Danny and folks like Steven, that I said draw that hard line between you and the execs. Kudos to both of you, or all three of you. Couple more things I wanted to ask, and then we can get out of here if you got the time. The title cards, absolutely beautiful for
Yeah.
Rocco. I love the title cards.
Yeah.
Was there any one person that was working on all the title cards, or were you doing some of the title cards for the episodes?
No, I didn't. I think I only did the pilot title card, but no, they were beautiful. It was Nick Jennings, Adriana Galvez, and Tim Barnes. They were the three artists that, and we had to work that into the budget, that there were going to be original art title cards in every episode, and usually the director had a say, whoever was directing that episode, and what the title card was going to look like, and they worked together. Yeah, they're amazing. I just actually had a bunch of them out.
Have you thought about doing a book with those? I don't know if you've got one out, but like all your title cards. I know there's been a couple of them that have done it for Cartoon Network. I know Fred did a book, Fred Seibert did a book with all the original What a Cartoon title cards and title placards and pilot title cards.
They've been included in a lot of books on animation, and there was a calendar actually that came
Oh,
out.
that's so dope.
Yeah, in 94, I guess. With just all the title card with 12 title cards as the monthly thing.
I'll go back and look for that one.
I have a few of those. But yeah, that was a really nice calendar. Yeah, I'm always trying to promote the art on those because they did such an amazing job. And yeah, Nick Jennings, I want to say a little bit about Nick Jennings because he was the art director on Rocco and he was also the art director on SpongeBob, the original art director. He's the one who came up with all the methods and of how to make Bikini Bottom and all that. But him and I were in an animation class in Northern California together. And that's how I met him. Crazy as fuck, because he was always doing something. And very, very enthusiastic. And then I was working on independent film at the time, and he said, "Can I come work with you?" And I said, "Sure." And so he did the backgrounds, but he was also like, "How are we going to shoot this? How are we going to do the?" And he was very instrumental in really, really pushing for the quality of it. And so he was so great. So then when I got the pilot, the Rocco pilot, of course, Nick is going to work with me along with George Maestri and a whole great crew of Northern California artists. But Nick became like one of the producers, and he always had crazy ideas because he always wanted to do it ourselves, like we were going to farm out this or hire a camera crew to shoot it. He goes, "Let's shoot it ourselves." Oh my God, Nick, really? He goes, "Yeah, it's the only way we're going to get good." Oh, we actually hired a camera crew with some guys from ILM, I remember. And they sent back some footage, and we said, "There's too many problems with this." And he goes, "Let's do it ourselves." I'm like, "Oh my God." So we installed a camera stand, big, huge 35 millimeter camera stand in one of our offices in the building that I had. And we shot, we would work all day on the pilot, shoot all night. We had a couch in there that we would take turns sleeping on. And after a while, I just had a permanent motel room where we would go and sleep and take showers. So we would shoot all night, and the only place you could get this film processed quickly was in San Francisco. And that was about a 45-minute drive from where we were. So we would drive in the morning to San Francisco, drop off the film. We'll look at the dailies from the day before, and a lot of times decide to shoot them again because we didn't like what was happening with it. And he was always like, "Let's do it, let's do it." And so, of course, when we got the show, he was my art director because he was brilliant. But he was also very, very like, "I want this to be." He goes, like, there were times when the production process was doing things to curb the quality. And he's like, "Joe, this is not what I signed on for. We are not doing that." And so he was like, "I agree with you. We'll get it. We'll fix it, you know." And then he went to, and then Steve had him as the art director on SpongeBob. And he did the same thing on SpongeBob. He was very, and anything he's worked on since, he has since become a producer in a lot of different projects, but he's so talented and so brilliant. And I just wanted to give him a shout out on him and his influence on 90s cartoons. He really, and he's so quiet. I don't even think he's on social media or anything. And I don't think a lot of people know that much about him. But he was like the U Byworks, Disney, where a lot of people didn't know how influential they were, he was. So.
Well, thank you for that shout out, because that's why we do this show. I mean, people know Joe, people know Mr. Lawrence, people know Charlie Adler, Steven, Danny Antonucci. Very far and few in between, unless you're like super nerdy about this, like me or yourself or anybody else that listens to the show or watches animation. They don't know the Tuck Tuckers. They don't know the Knicks. They don't know these board artists and these background artists and these people that helped shape, mold, and keep the standard for a show. They set the pace and everybody else had to match their pace. You know what I mean? So I do this show because there are so many people out there that know the cartoons, but they don't know the people that did it. And that's why I love doing this. I love putting a spotlight on people that had a hand, a fingerprint, whatever you want to call it, on shaping and molding me, good, bad, or indifferent, to the person I am today. So shout out to Nick, man. Maybe we can get him on the show, give him a bigger spotlight so we can really put his face out there. And you know
I
what I
don't
mean?
know if he would do it because
Probably not, but
he's very
nonetheless.
quiet and reserved in a lot of ways, except when he is working on a project that he really wants to succeed, he can get. But also, we were starting from scratch on Rocco to put a production process together to accommodate the storyboard driven process. And Nick had a lot to do with that, but also there were a few George Maestri also there were we had to put our heads together to try and figure out how it was going to work and with the board. We had four board teams and how we were going to traverse the production landscape to do that. And so we had to throw out anything that had been done before. That's if we had a producer who said that's not the way we do it, then goodbye. So we really started from scratch, and Steve used that same process, and I think it was used on a different. I'm not sh it, probably variations of it have been used since then, but it was a different type of a thing. So anyway, there were a lot of people who were influential, and because people don't know the behind the scenes stuff of how, because you have to make if you want something creatively to excel, and it's a volume environment. You have to find a way to do it because volume fights you, and at every stand, schedules fight you. And that's another thing that Steve did, which I was, because we would do overlaps of seasons. We would be working on a third season writing while we were doing a second season board and a first season post-production. That was a typical day. But Steve, when he started doing SpongeBob, said, I don't want any overlap. I want to just do the first season from start to finish. When we're done, we start the next season. And I was like, oh my God, you're going to lose your crew, Steve. He goes, I don't care. They'll come back. And but it worked really well. They don't do it now, but they did back then for the first three seasons, I think he did it that way, which is very unheard of because it costs a lot more money. And you do lose your crew sometimes because there's a big hiatus gap. That was my big thing to try and keep the crew together. But so another kudos to Steve for that because it really helped with the volume situation.
Absolutely. And one of the last things I wanted to ask you, man. You had an all-star cast. I've had Carlos on, I've had Charlie on. I haven't had Mr. Lawrence or Tom on yet. Just talking to Carlos and Charlie in particular, I mean, I've never had somebody on with as much wit and as much energy as Ch like Charlie. Like, as soon as he knows where that red fucking light is, and as soon as it's on, I don't think he's never off. What was it like? What is your favorite memory of that voice cast? Is there one where you were laughing so hard that you can recall or you can think of? Or what was it like trying to corral those crazy motherfuckers into one area to get what you needed?
Well, Yeah, that's incidentally, I think they're all keep an eye on when that red light goes on because they perform. They and are always trying to make each other laugh, which was very difficult because but funny. I always wanted to record ensemble, which is where everybody's in the room at the time. So we had a big recording room at this studio where we did our sound. And I would sit in there with him, which I didn't like being in the booth. I wanted to be in there with him. And it was Tom Kenny's first gig. It was Carlos's first gig. I think he had done some other voice stuff on commercials, I think, or something. But this was his first show. And Charlie was the veteran. And Charlie was extremely busy with lots of voice work. And Tom and Carlos not so busy. So they were having fun. And Doug also. Doug had not done a voice on a show before. So they would riff. Like in between takes, they would go off onto a monologue. And Charlie was like, "We're trying to do a recording here." Like they were like, oh. They were all a little intimidated by Charlie because Charlie was loud and he had this way of when he would record, he would have the script on his stand, and as soon as he was done with his line, he would take it and like violently throw the paper, and so you're just like, what? That's crazy, you know. It's like in a cartoon fashion, you just see this. And he would be doing, "Oh, Rocco, oh," and he kept going back and forth with Ed and Bev, and it was just craziness. And we were just all, watch this thing happen. And he's like, "I have to go now. It's getting really late." Like, okay, but Tom and yeah, so that was crazy. When we did the recording for Static Cling, it was the first time these guys had been together working on this stuff in a long time. And so some Nickelodeon marketing person got the bright idea of, "Let's invite the press in for this recording session." Like, that's not a good idea. Like, we're trying to, record here. It's like, "Oh no, they'll just be really quiet. They'll be back there, just filming." I say, "You don't understand these guys. If they know there's a camera on,
they're gonna go.
they will not be paying attention to their work." And they go, "Oh no, yeah, I'll tell them. We'll tell them to be very quiet. They're just gonna, you won't even notice they're there." Sure enough, there's a video actually, which somebody sent to me recently of that recording session, because I am sitting there just like I have this look on my face, like, "This is fucking happening," because the guys are performing. They're like, we're getting some lines recorded, but it's always like in between. There's banter. There's, whatever. I'm not against having fun in a recording session, but I needed to get this thing recorded. That's why we were there. And it was hard enough also trying to make sure that we were doing this with the right voice as before, and and we all had grown older, and Charlie Adler was funny but cranky, so we finished the video is hilarious because I am just like, I'm pissed, and you can and I'm not hiding it. And Tom comes, you're just acting like you're not liking anything that we're doing." And I go, "No, that's not it." So we had to book another recording session afterwards to record it. seriously recorded. And I said, nobody is going to be in that room except for us because we cannot get anything done. So,
They were hamming it up.
you're right. But they love making each other laugh. Comedians love nothing more to make than to make another comedian laugh. And Tom is always on. Tom Kenny, my God, he would just have you on the floor with his stuff. And then when they go off swearing in the Rocco voices, that's especially Doug Lawrence, because Filbert would be going off into this horrible stuff about his dick and all sorts of stuff. So anyway,
Old turtle dick.
it was a lot of fun. Well, we had an episode called Born to Spawn, where I think Steve directed that too, Steve Hellenberg. And so he suddenly gets an urge that he has to go to Kerpalpagos Island to spawn and mate. And there were so many. I wish we could have had outtakes from that episode because he turns into this horny turtle. Anyway.
Well, thank you for sharing those and the stories you've shared. Now I know you're working on an independent film, and you're also got a Patreon that you would love people to know about. So if you want to talk about any, I don't know if anything about the independent film is still kept under wraps, if you're still making it. So I don't want to ask you too many questions if you don't want to talk about it, but I do know we could talk about the Patreon if you don't want to talk about the film just yet.
Yeah, well, it's kind of, I have been talking about it. I just released my let me backtrack to like I left Hollywood and moved to Belgium, you know that. So I'm on a farm, we bought a farm. So I have animals and crops and all that stuff. And then we turned one of the stables into a studio for me, which is where I am now. And I decided to go back to independent film because I really loved it. It's just been so incredible for me. It's been amazing to work in indie film for a while. And I totally shut myself off from everything for 2 years. And I finished my first film back, which was Fiego and the Magic Fish, which has actually been something I was working on for a long time, and always got sidetracked and never finished it. I actually re recorded a script once with Carlos on it, and Jeff Bennett, who played Raj on Camp Lazlo, was also on it. And I ended up scrapping it and started over. But anyway, so that came out, and it's on the festival trail. It's won a few awards, which is very nice. I just got back from Barcelona where it screened at a festival there. So I'm working, on my new film. And I started a Patreon page because I just the post-production work on Fiego. Let me just preface, like Carlos did this really great thing for me on Instagram where I said, maybe you could just mention my Patreon page. And he goes through this whole thing, Joe Murray, who's like the greatest of all time, needs our help. Like, and it sounded like Joe's on the street and he is living in a tent. You can help him now for only 39 cents a day. You can help out an animator who's down and is like, that's not the way it is. I'm not destitute. I'm not broken. I'm not starving. We're having a great life here. The only thing is that post-production on an indie film, since I don't have any outside funding, gets to be a little expensive if I want it to be good, and I do want it to be good. So I thought maybe, I have kind of a fan base, and maybe I can exchange what I know with filmmaking and TV, and also throw some things from my archives, like my title cards that I was on, and we can have an exchange. You can become a Patreon member, and we can build a little community. So that's what it's been, and it's great. We have a really good group of people. It's not large, but that means I pay more attention to them because there's a small group. But but I would love more. So anybody wants to come along and join our community, it's patreon.com/JoeMurray24, I believe. And Fiego and the Magic Fish has its own site, fiegoandthemagicfish.com, if you want to follow its thing. So the new film it's called Odin and the Egg, and it's kind of a Norse tale done in my weird manner. So I don't know when it's going to be done. I'm just enjoying it.
You should, man.
Yeah, and see, animation for me it's like one of those things that if you love what you do, things happen, you know. And I had no intention of going into television, but it did, but it's because I loved animation so much, and I still do. So just getting down to the actual drawing of, so I did every drawing, every background, everything on this film, maybe that's because I'm a control freak. I don't know. Maybe so. But I go to these festivals and I see these animated films with this long scroll of all these people. And I'm like, it's me and my daughter Daisy Murray, who also worked with me on the film, did a lot of color work and stuff. And so it was just the two of us. Myra Stamm did the music composition with an orchestra in Macedonia, and Mike Mancuso did the sound. It's brilliant. I really liked it. I was saying it's brilliant. The sound was brilliant. You have to say it yourself if you see the film, but I'll probably start streaming it after its festival run. But other than that, go to a nearest festival that has it. So. Yeah, so the Patreon page, it would be great if you could come and help support the film.
Absolutely. And all those links will be in the description below. And all of those links will be, when we go to share this episode, we'll also post up the Patreon link, give people, what do they call that shit? I'm trying to think of the word. Whenever we start to release an episode, with whoever we got on, we'll go, hey, this is this week's episode. So we'll put up a couple stories with your Patreon link and then the website link for your film that's out now that's going through the circuit. That way we can start to drum up some traffic towards it and hopefully help you out some, so we can get more eyes on what you're doing. Like I said, I love when folks like yourself, anybody in the animation industry, because there's so many drawings that we don't get to see. There's so many things that we don't get to see that we would love to see from the behind the scenes to the post-production to even if it's just a concept that you're working on. We love seeing you guys post some stuff. So anytime we can help drive some traffic towards that, I know there's a fan base out there and we're gonna help you find it too. Like I said, Joe, this has been fantastic. I've been trying to get you on for quite some time because you were one of those guys that I had on my list when I started this originally. I was like, one day I'm going to talk to Joe. 4 years later, here I am talking to Joe. The last thing we always like to ask everybody before we sign off, before we hit end and say goodbye, if you could sum up Rocco's modern life in one word, one phrase, one sentence, one paragraph, what would your summary of your that time of Rocco, both the series as well as Static Cling, what would you say about that time?
About the time working on it, or the show itself, or the concept itself.
Just in general, if when you think about Rocco, is there one word, one emotion, one phrase that comes to mind whenever you think about
Yeah,
Rocco?
well, yeah, and this is kind of what I've brought up before when people talk about Rocco, is that it's modern life, and that is it in a nutshell. Because anytime, and I said this even to the president of Nickelodeon. These issues are modern life. It's what we're going through, and it's it, I want to say something about it, about what we're going through, and the changes and the new things and the technology and the social issues and the new sexual orientations that people are able to be free with, which is fantastic, and all sorts of things that are coming out. And it always is modern life. And modern to me is like, okay, we're in the moment, we're now, and But it's going to be challenges. And of course, Rocco had its challenges, and that's what we relate to because, you traverse this landscape. It's got a lot of bumps and valleys and but also peaks and so that's really where I've always come from with the show, and that's what I still believe in the show is that it's us, and Rocco is the everyman, so to speak, the center of the hurricane, as I've called it, seeing things go on around him. So here's my cat.
Beautiful. What a fitting way to end it. Well, Joe, like I said, man, thank you again for your time. This has been an absolute blast. He's been Joe. I've been Julian. It's been a What's in My Head podcast, and it's been another PC for Childhood. Good night. All right, as we take a pause for the cause, if you haven't yet, you should check us out on all social media platforms by searching at In My Head Pod. There you can see who we've got coming on, and if you feel so inclined to, you can submit a question to be asked. Hey guys, thanks for listening. Before we go, thank you so much for spending a little bit of time with the podcast today. I truly appreciate every download and listen we get. If you're liking what we're doing, drop us a 5-star rating, drop us a review, tell a friend, and I'll see you next week.